Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Megan from the 1 o'clock women's meeting in Harrisburg.
All right. Hey, everybody. I'm Megan Dix. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Megan.
And, wow. All right, I know, I'm space efficient. Been working on that one for a while. Okay, so what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I should start with my sobriety days, April 3rd, 1999. We have a home group. It's the 1 o'clock Wednesday women's meeting. It meets at Camp Hill. And I'm currently looking for a sponsor. My sponsor just was given a direction, got rid of all of their sponsees, and so we're all kind of running around going, what are we going to do now? So, it's interesting. I haven't been without a sponsor for quite some time, but, you know, I feel blessed because I have some really good connections with a lot of people in my area, so I have a lot of people that I call, I can talk to, have a good support system, so. All right. So what it was like, I don't really feel like I need to get into a whole lot of what it was like when I grew up. When we were all kids, we come from different situations. You know, there were some things that were really great about my childhood, some things that were not so great about my childhood. But I don't really believe that any of those things are why I'm an alcoholic. All I can tell you is, for whatever reason, that as far back as I can remember, there's always been that voice in the back of my head that was always telling me, Megan, you're not good enough, smart enough, strong enough, pretty enough, rich enough, whatever you want to fill that blank in, I didn't have it. And so I always felt like I didn't fit, that if I just worked a little bit harder, that maybe I could convince you to like me, or if I couldn't get you to like me, then I had to try to figure out how to be invisible. And, you know, I think probably by about high school, there's just stuff going on at home, and I really had no way of coping with anything. I had no coping skills. I didn't know how to deal with anything. I didn't talk about my feelings. I was that kid up until that point that I did my homework, put my head down, and waited for the end of the school day, and, you know, went home and hoped that things weren't too insane when I got home. And, I read a lot. That was my escape growing up. And it wasn't until probably like junior year, things got crazy. My parents didn't really know what to make of me because I was just always this quiet kid that I tried really hard to fix everything. I always thought it was my job to like keep the peace, to make sure everything was okay. Tried to control every situation because I felt like if I could control the situation, I could keep people from leaving, from fighting, from whatever it was. I just always thought that was my job, was to just make sure everything was okay. And I spent all my time walking around on eggshells. And 11th grade, I just snapped. I mean, there's really no other way of putting it other than just I was just done. And so my parents thought it would be a good idea to have me committed, and so I missed a marking period of my junior year, and that was fun. And so surrounded by all these people that I still didn't feel like I had a voice, and I mean, that's pretty much always been how I felt, was just that not enough, not enough, not enough, not enough. And even if you told me, so, you know, I'm in a place where I'm supposed to be able to say, this is how I feel, whatever, didn't feel like I could do that. And got out, started a outpatient day program, was not really happy with the way they were running things. I think my second day, I took a month's worth of sleeping pills and then went and sat back down in class. Don't really remember a whole lot after that until I got to the emergency room and had that really amazing experience of having my stomach pumped. having a delicious charcoal shake, and then riding in the elevator. It's just not good. And still not really connecting with what's going on in my life at that point. I was just done. And since I didn't feel like I could talk or I could participate or I had any control, I was just done. And when I got out again and had to go back and finish the outpatient program, they loved me. I went back to school, and I was terrified. Because up until that point, I had managed to just kind of be in the background and stay out of trouble and really just stay off the radar. And I had just gotten to this point with life and I was just done. I was mad. I was angry because I didn't measure up. I didn't feel like I measured up. And I was tired of living like everybody was better than me. And I was just angry about a whole lot of stuff. And so the night before I went back to school, I pierced my nose, I got a new wardrobe, and I told the first teacher to F off, and that's pretty much how it went. I made some new friends, and we had some fun extracurricular activities. started cutting classes, just started getting into different outlets. Didn't really start drinking until probably the summer between my junior and senior year. I'm not entirely sure when I had my first drink because I was a blackout drinker from the door. I can tell you about the time period, the people that I was probably with at that time, because the first time that I remember drinking, the parts that I remember of that night was conversations of how this is just like the other night and I don't remember the other night. So I'm assuming I must have blacked out. From the beginning, alcohol was amazing. Suddenly that voice that just continued to just never stop talking. It's like that hamster wheel of, well, why don't you like me? What do I need to do to get you to like me? What do I get you to do to think about me and recognize me, or not think that, but think this? And no, I don't, you know, and it just never stopped. And it was just this constant micromanagement of every minute. And it was excruciating because I never lived up to my own standards, apparently. I don't know what everybody else was measuring against, but I never measured up. And I hated myself. And I lived at that time, you know, alcohol gave me this really great opportunity of suddenly being extemporaneous. I love that word they use in the literature, because suddenly I was able to make eye contact, have a conversation, pretend that I could dance. Sometimes it ended up in some interesting places, you know, but from the door, things got, I can't even say they got out of control because they were never in control. From the minute that I knew that I was going to drink, that was all I focused on. And I didn't drink very often because, you know, 18, I wasn't old enough. So I spent 99% of my time with people who were old enough to get me what I needed. And spent all my energy convincing you to get what I needed for me. And so that led to some interesting situations with people that I was friends with, because I had no problem, you know, leading people on, helping you look for something that I had already taken from you. I mean, I was just a really miserable individual. And, you know, it was whatever I needed to do to get what I needed so that I didn't have to be up here. Because drinking turned all that off. And it was quiet. And I was okay. And it didn't matter that I was probably going to regret this tomorrow. Because maybe if I'm really lucky, tomorrow won't happen. And that's pretty much how I lived. So alcohol took me some very interesting, very scary, very not nice places. And I met some very interesting, not so nice, scary people along the way. And I bounced back and forth between my parents' houses because neither of them wanted to deal with me. I should say for the record that my dad was a drug and alcohol counselor, a recovering alcoholic, and a minister. Yeah, see, somebody knows. So I was the preacher's kid. And my first babysitters were guys from my dad's drug and alcohol program. And, you know, I look back and I don't think I realized at the time, obviously it wasn't until much later in my step work, what I put them through. But my dad gave me a pager, and when he hadn't heard from me for a while, I would usually get a page, and I was usually so drunk or high that I didn't recognize my own number, and I would call, and my dad would say, "Oh, good, you're still alive, and he'd hang up." I mean, that's kind of the way it went for a while. So, senior year, this is pretty much how it's going. I make a great new impression at my new school. I think the second or third week of school, I threw a party, apparently. I told one person that my dad was going to be away, and, you know, open the door, and like 40 people walk in, and everybody knew my name, and it was great. Except Sunday morning, I had to go pick him up at the airport, and I was still driving people home in my PJs, and we were trying to make sure that we matched all the bottle caps to the bottles so that there wasn't any evidence left. And I heard about things from that day that I have no idea, and I'm probably very grateful that I don't remember a lot of that. And then, you know, I lasted at the new school halfway through my senior year, and then I moved back to my mom's. Went back to my old school, and had to make up some really great ideas to why I had been at a different school, and instantly fell back in with all the same people that I had, you know, been hanging out with before, same extracurricular activities. I'm like literally spending class periods laying on the floor sleeping. I'm not even sure how I graduated. You know, I was just at this point where, you know, at 18, I was already just existing. I don't even want to say that I was living at that point because I just didn't care anymore. I was just done. And, I just continually kept pushing that envelope of how much could I drink and pass out and how fast could I do it? You know, I don't think I ever drank anything because of how it tasted. You know, I've heard people like, "Oh, if I could just take one," and I'm like, "Why? What?" I remember being in a meeting years ago and somebody talking about wishing that they could just have a drink with their dinner, and I just looked at them and I said, "What would be the point of that? I don't understand." I don't think I ever did one of anything. Because everything, the sole point was to get as completely drunk as possible so that I could turn off my head. And I spent 30 days in the beginning of 1999 on ulcer medication because I was having all these stomach problems and they couldn't figure out why, and I was just really stressed. Good Friday was my last night out drinking. I spent it drinking at an ex-boyfriend that I hadn't seen in a while. I'm not sure where he was at the time, but it seemed like a good idea to drink at him because I was angry at that night. I ended up at a party, and I'm not sure who I knew at the party to get to the party. I vaguely remember bits and pieces of that night. I spent most of the night with my head in a trash can puking blood. The next morning, they were really awesome. They slowed down by my dad's house just enough to push me out the door, and then they took off. Because they'd met my dad, they didn't want to meet him again. So my dad always wanted to talk to people about what they were doing with their life. And people I was hanging out with were not interested in having that conversation. So I walked through the porch door, and I walked past my dad. I think he was watching football or something at the time. And I tried really hard to stay upright. I was trying really hard to give the impression of an upright, sober individual. Leaned across. I just remember walking the long hallway back to my room and just, like, sagging against it. There was, like, a line from my shoulder for months. Made it to my room, keeled over in my bed. I'm not sure how long later, my phone rang. Apparently I had paged somebody, which I don't remember doing. And of all the people that I would have contacted at that time, this was not the person that I would have called. And she's like, "So how's it going?" I was like, "Not great." Because as I was laying there, I had this moment of clarity where I just wasn't afraid of dying. But the idea of living like I was living for any length of time terrified me. The idea that maybe I would die, that I would just be stuck like this for years, that terrified me. So she says, "Well, you know what you got to do." And I was like, "But I don't want to." She said, "Really?" So I walked back out, dropped the phone in my dad's lap, walked back to my room. And I guess they talked for a little while, because, see, this was one person that I think I partied with more consistently than everybody else. So she saw, because I tried to split up groups. That way nobody saw a complete picture of the complete train wreck that I was at that time. And so if I kept everybody in different groups, then, you know, I didn't have to worry about you knowing the story that I told that person, or, she was mad at me because I flirted with her boyfriend, or just I stole their whatever. It was just easier to keep everybody separated. But she ended up in more groups than anybody else, and so she knew. She had a pretty good idea of just how bad things had gotten. So after a while, my dad came back, and he's like, "So you done?" I just kind of went, "Yeah, I think so." He said, "Okay, cool. I called somebody. She'll be here in about 10 minutes." I was like, "What?" Apparently, she lived right across the parking lot in our apartment complex. So she walks in, and she took a look at me, and she said, "Well, you're going to brush your teeth, you're going to put on something that doesn't have vomit on it, and you're going to get in my car. Got it?" She was not my favorite person. She was all happy and bubbly, and, you know, she tried to hug me. So I went to a meeting, and it was Saturday night, and it was standing room only. And I sat by the back door on the floor with my feet out in the aisle and just glared at everybody. Because I really wanted to make sure that you all knew that I really didn't want to be there. Because at 19, I was okay. And I didn't raise my hand when they asked if there was anybody new, in spite of the dirty looks that she was giving me. And then everybody got up and they got in a circle, and I was like, "Oh, okay, I got this. Okay, now I know why I'm here." And I was like, "Oh, my dad and I are going to have words when I get home." And then I got mobbed. Apparently there's a whole bunch of home group members, and they just knew. I had newcomer written all over me. And they hugged me, and they're like, "How's it going?" I was like, "Not good. Clearly, I'm 19 and I'm at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. How great do you think it's going?" And they still tried to hug me. And they're like, "Come back. Are you coming back tomorrow?" And I was like, "Well, I came today. Isn't that enough?" No. We went to meetings every day. And showed up. I drank coffee. Chain smoked a lot of cigarettes, and then there was a few meetings where, you know, she'd look at me and she'd go, "You should just go ahead and empty those ashtrays out for the meeting," and I'd say, "Okay," because really, at that point, she was the only person that wanted me around, or at least tolerated me being around. I had become that person that everybody told her kids to stay away from, It's true. Stay away from that girl. She's trouble. You know, I started going to meetings, and, you know, then her and I would talk afterwards or during the day because I had no life. I was living at home. I had no job, so I didn't have gas money. So I spent a lot of time at her house because conveniently it was like right there. And she's like, well, clearly you can't be left by yourself, which I really, really wanted to be offended. But really, clearly, my track record was not looking so good. Left my own devices, I end up in not great places, and my brilliant ideas are generally best if everybody runs when I have a brilliant idea. So I, you know, sat down, we started going through the book. And yeah, I remember we're talking about step one, and, you know, she's like, well, are you powerless over alcohol? And I was like, well, it's a really strong word. Out of control? Okay, okay. Problematic? Yeah, I could, problematic, I could work with that. Yeah, absolutely. Powerlessness, I don't know. That's, and she's like, so let's recap. She just started going down the list of all the things that I had been honest with her at that point, which I was regretting. And, But the reality was I had no idea what's going to happen when I put a chemical into my body. You know, that allergy to the body that it talks about in the literature is, you know, first I have that, you know, the obsession of the mind of I need that substance to make me okay, to turn everything off, to make it all stop, to be okay. And then I put this chemical into my body and I have no idea what's going to happen when I drink. It could be a relatively benign night. Generally, that's not the case. Generally, it ended up with me making some interesting new friends. Also, side note, I'm really, really grateful that Facebook wasn't around when I was drinking. I would not be employable. But, like, that was my only solution. Because I had no coping skills. I had no life skills. I didn't know how do you deal with things. I don't know. You drink until you don't care about the things anymore. That's all I knew. And so I kind of was like, yeah, okay, I think you're right. Okay. And she's like, so do you think your life's unmanageable? And I was like, yeah, I totally got that one. I'm not even gonna argue with that. Okay, yeah. So we just kind of went through the steps. Was not real happy. I really wanted to tell you I was an atheist when I came in, but it's hard to say you're an atheist when you're mad at God. So I was like, I'll just say I'm agnostic. I will ignore it as it's been ignoring me, and we're good. We talked about insanity and how, you know, insanity is admitting that I'm powerless and I'm still trying to control my life, like I have some sort of power. She's like, isn't that insanity? And I was like, oh, it's like you're really smart. It's annoying. Because I really, really, really didn't want this to work. I was looking for the loophole when I got here because I really wanted my dad to be wrong, first of all. Second of all, I was 19. I hadn't even had a legal drink yet. I had a whole ton of yets. And some of them I was hoping to achieve. Most of them, no. But there was a few that I was really hoping that I could, you know, cross off the list that, you know, everybody, you know, crosses off the list of normal people. You know, when I looked at the insanity of my life, and she said, okay, so if we remove the great bearded guy in the sky from the picture, is it possible to look at your life till this point and see that in spite of yourself, you're still here? Like, yeah. Because I've tried a few times, and I'm still here. So either I'm really bad at, like, offing myself, which is also true, because I'm still here, or there's a plan. And I was kind of not entirely sure how comfortable I was, but I was... At that point, I had come to enough meetings and I'd talked to enough people and I'd heard enough hope in the meetings that just maybe, if I did what you did, I wouldn't feel how I felt. And I really didn't want to feel like that anymore. So I was on the scale of willingness, it slightly favored being open-minded to whatever, bearded guy in the sky and all. So I said, okay, I can see that something is working in my life in spite of myself. Okay, step two, good. Step three. She's like, so step three is really making a commitment, which I was really bad at. And I reminded her of this, and she said, that's okay. To the best of your ability, can you make an agreement to work all 12 steps, and then we'll reevaluate? So that's it. She said, well, yeah, the GOD in your life right now is this good orderly direction. Working the program to the best of your ability, and see what happens. I said, well, I feel like this is a trap. She said, it is. I said, oh. And you're being upfront about it? Okay, all right, what have I got to lose? Nothing, I had nothing but misery and so self-loathing. So she said, if I know that I've done my third step when I'm actively working on my fourth step. So I worked on my fourth step. That was the easy part, making a list of all the people that I was mad at. People that I was still, you know, at the end, drinking at that I hadn't seen in years, that probably didn't even know who I was anymore. That lady in the grocery store that, you know, cut in front of me. Just, you know, I was mad at everybody and everything. And it was all everybody else's fault. Because I was a victim. That was my battle cry when I was drinking, is, you know, I would end up in these really awful situations and I'd play the card of like, but it's not my fault. And then we did the fifth step, where I got to look at, okay, so decision A, did you know that was a bad decision? Kinda, okay. So that led you to situation B, where you made another bad decision. Yeah, okay. So, and we would go down this chain until I ended up in this situation, and she said, even if down here, you had no control over this, did you go into this having a part in it? I was like, yes. She's like, so your problems are a direct result of you. That hurt. I think that's probably the most painful recognition, a moment of clarity that I've had in sobriety. I mean, there's been a few. But that first one where, like, the entire way that I had formed my world around me to justify the way that I was living and to come smack up against the reality of 99% of the problems in my life were a direct result of me was really hard to look at. That hurt. My ego, my everything wanted me to just cut and run at that point. And she said, but there's hope. I was like, you with the bubbly hope. Okay, lay it on me. And she's like, well, if 99% of the problems are your fault and you stop acting like an idiot, your life gets better. And I was like, okay. If I stop living the way that I'm living and I stop making decisions based on the same faulty ideas, I might get new results. I really... like, she was so sincere and just matter-of-fact about it. And I said, that sounds really simple. And she's like, it's simple, but it's not easy. She said, you actually have to be willing to do something different. You know, maybe sometimes run things past people when you get your brilliant ideas. Okay, I can do that. So I had this big, long list of things that... we had agreed that I needed to work on. Took that into 6 and 7. Some of them I prayed to be willing to give them up. She's like, that's okay, it's a start. That's somewhere, we'll take it. I said, okay. 8, Some of them were pretty obvious, and some of them I was like, okay, yep, absolutely. Because when I, you know, once we really got past that initial direct result of Megan's bad thinking and my bad judgment and my selfish and self-centered motives, when I looked at that and that ripple effect of how my actions and attitudes affected the people around me, it was a lot easier for me to recognize that I owed a lot of people amends. Some of them I was more willing than others to make. Some of them did not have any interest in sitting down and talking to me. 18 years later, they still don't want to talk to me. And that's okay. I'm willing to make the amend if it comes up and they're ever ready. So I made the amends that I could to the best of my ability, except for one. I refused. I said, nope, it's never happening. She said, okay, we'll just keep moving. And, you know, worked through, you know, the rest of the steps. Got a coffee commitment. They gave me a key to a church. Yeah. It's like, these people don't know who I am. I get kicked out of churches. You don't give me keys to a church. But they gave me the key to a church. They told me I could make the coffee. The sacred coffee. And I was like, I don't know what's wrong with you people, but okay, I got nowhere else to be. Okay. And so, you know, I showed up and I made coffee and I set up the meeting. And I was so excited to have that opportunity to earn my word back. Because it hadn't meant anything. You know, at 19, my sister, who was 12, would much rather have told people that I was her babysitter than that we were related. And that was if she had no way of getting out of spending time with me in public. And, you know, so the fact that, you know, somebody told me that I was given some responsibilities, like, I was kind of blown away about it. You know, I mean, as much as I joked about it, it was like, are you serious? You really want to give me the key? Like, I can get in any time. If I came over at 3 a.m., I could get in. And they're like, yeah. Do you have a reason to be there at 3 a.m.? I was like, well, no. And they're like, well, then I trust you. And I was like, okay. All right. I'm not sure that's okay. Sure. You know, but my sponsor kept telling me, you know, like it talks about in the literature, if I'm willing to make my amends and I'm willing to do this thing, I'm going to get some peace of mind. And I was like, all right, I'm willing to do some of these things. I'd started to experience some of the fifth step promises in my life. Yeah, I remember hearing the ninth step promises in a meeting early on, and I was like, that's some fancy stuff. Still lived at home. Hadn't lost a whole lot of things to worry about getting them back. They were, you know, financial insecurity. Like, I was looking for change in the bottom of my dad's car. So over where I was at. But I remember being in a meeting and somebody read the fifth step promises, which I'm going to read them because they're my favorite thing in the entire world. And I kept going back to this, that every step, going through the rest of the steps, you know, when I was doing, you know, completing my eight-step list, and this is why I was doing this, and my nine-step amends, and doing my 10-step, and doing my 11-step, and getting a service commitment, and you know, doing these things, the reason that I was doing this is because I really wanted this. It says, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken the step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. Our fears fall from us. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And I remember hearing that. I was like, that's what I want. That being able to look the world in the eye, being at peace and ease, those were the two things that I have been looking for my entire life. Because I didn't have to do that. I had no peace. I had no internal peace. I definitely couldn't look you in the eye, because if I looked you in the eye, you were going to figure out who I was. And if you figured out who I was, then you were going to go running away screaming, because you were clearly a lot saner than I was. And that's all I wanted. So that was my incentive to keep doing those things. And so that's what I did. I got involved in service. You know, I was an intergroup rep. I was a GSR. I was involved with a young people's convention. We bid for a year and a half. And then when we got the bid, then we worked for a year to host it. And then I was on the advisory board for a few years. So I, a couple weeks, I think I had about a week sober. My sponsor was talking to somebody after the meeting, and apparently the guy that he brought to the meeting needed to get back to his house. He was on house arrest, and it was getting close to curfew. And he's like, dude, just tell them to come over, finish the conversation, whatever, we just gotta go. And so my sponsor's like, that's a great idea. I was like, are you crazy? And so we went over and hung out, and apparently they had people that got together every week on Friday nights to play board games. And I walked in and I looked at her and I said, are you crazy? Board games? Do I look like I play board games? And she said, you do now. I was like, and we did that every week. And something really amazing happened. So I was watching these people that got together every week, and they were doing something that I was completely incapable of doing. They had genuine relationships with one another. They had real friendships. They asked each other how they were doing, what's going on in your life, how's that amends with your mom going, have you talked to your daughter yet, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they were like involved, caring, reciprocal friendships. And I had no idea how to do that. And so a couple months later, we're still hanging out, and everybody leaves, and it's just me and a house arrest guy. Did I mention that he was living in his grandmother's basement for house arrest? Yeah. And so we got married 4 years later. And you know, I went from being that kid that everybody told her kids to stay away from. So then I was going to meetings. I was still probably the kid you should stay away from until she gets sober for a little while, because, you know, I wasn't real stable. And, had no interest in fuzzy friendships and kids. Did I mention she said my sponsor had an 18-month-old that she left me with frequently? She's like, I gotta run to the store, you can watch Katie. And I was like, what do I do with her? I had no idea what to do with this kid, and the kid did not like me, and I wasn't a big fan of hers. So, house arrest guy, we're married. We had one kid, and that was great. I hadn't screwed up too badly. Got pregnant with triplets. Not on purpose. The universe is a sense of humor. That's all I'm going to say. And I bring this up. So my, the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So my journey with having had a spiritual awakening has changed quite a bit over the years. For a while, I was really concerned because I felt like it was expected of me to have this well-defined God before I could do my steps, or that I was somehow doing something wrong because I was working the steps and still didn't have some well-defined, you know, when people's like, well, who's your higher power? I'm like, I don't know. Not me. So for me, it kind of goes back to like when I was initially working that second step of looking for those God moments in my life, the things that were clearly not me, the things that clearly had no control over, the things that clearly showed that there was a guiding hand in my life. So the day that the triplets were 7 months old, we were moving into a new house, and my dad had been living overseas at this time, and he'd been sick, and I get a call that my dad has passed. And when my dad was here, before he got really sick, he was obsessed with motorcycles and ponytails. His like last hurrah was, he's like, you know what, I've never had a ponytail, I really should, you know. So before he lost it all to chemo, he was like growing out as much hair as he possibly could, which we picked on him incessantly for. It's like, Dad, you got enough Grecian formula for that? Are you sure? You know, so ponytails and motorcycles. So I get this call, and we're in the process of moving. There's furniture coming and going. You know, my older son's he just turned 3. He's running around, you know, trying to help people. That goes there, you know, being helpful. And walk in, and the triplets were all sitting up at this point. And they're sitting in this little circle, just kind of hanging out, doing whatever seven-month-olds do. I think they're rolling a ball and stuff. And my one daughter just looks at me. And she just kind of looked at me for a minute. And I was like, hey, Rain. And she goes, which, I don't know if any of you know anything about kids, but that's not something seven-month-old kids do. That's a very specific movement that really, she shouldn't have been able to do that at that point. She just looks at me and she does that, like for a good 30 seconds, and then she just kind of goes back to doing what she's doing. Has never done it since. She's 9. So, coincidence, maybe. For me, that's part of this, I'm looking for those signs that I'm in the right place, that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, for me, today, working with new people coming through the program, you know, sponsoring somebody and walking them through these steps and watching that light come on in their eyes is like the most amazing thing, you know, to walk somebody through that when they have that moment of, holy crap, there's hope. I don't have to live like this anymore. And, you know, I look for those moments. You know, when I get up in the morning, I would love to tell you that I have this great, you know, I get up at 5 and I make coffee and I sit, and I know people that do that and that's awesome. That's not me. I wish it was, but the reality is it's not me. I've tried to do that and I just end up falling asleep on the floor late for work. But what I do in the mornings is I try to sit. Just, you know, even if it's just on my way to work, or I try to get to work like 10 minutes early so I can just sit at my desk, because usually there's nobody in the office, and just sit and just focus on, how can I be of service today? Whether it's to another alcoholic, whether it's to my coworkers, whether it's to, you know, the people in my life, whatever it is, how can I be of service today? What can I do to make today better for somebody else? When I do that, I'm less likely to be a jerk. And, I feel at the end of the day, when I sit down and I have a buddy that we text each other, you know, how, you know, our stack of how did our day go. And, you know, I've been doing enough with her that, you know, when I see a pattern, I'm like, I really don't want to have to tell her that I did this again. So what can I do differently today? Which is good. That means it's working, right? Being open to seeing these patterns in my life, because I don't ever want to go back to being that person. I don't ever want to go back to feeling like that. I don't ever want to go back to that completely hopeless state of mind and body where I loathed every minute that I was conscious because I hated myself so much. I am not going to tell you that I'm going to hop up every morning and high-five myself in the mirror, and you know, but I'm okay with me today, which is amazing. You know, I'm an okay mom today. I'm doing the things that, you know, I'm a productive member of society. Go figure. But, you know, when it talks about having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, Yeah, when I have somebody say, well, what's in it for me if I do these steps? I'm like, well, see number 12? That's where it says result. So it goes back to that conversation that I had with my sponsor early on about, you know, making this decision, making a commitment to turn my will and my life over until I've thoroughly worked all 12 steps. And I was like, it's a trap. She said, absolutely. Because by the time you get to 12, if you're being thorough, you're not going to want to go back to how you felt. And in my experience, that's the truth. Doesn't mean everything's great and wonderful and, you know, everything goes my way, because that's just not the way it works. But what I have today is I have a set of tools that allows me to live life on life's terms, that I can be okay no matter what. When my dad died, I was able to be there for the people in my family that don't have a program, that don't have a support system in their life, because there are a lot of different other groups out there, but a lot of people in my family don't have that. Most of them are still drinking. And I was able to be there and be of service to them. When my husband's grandmother, you know, was really ill, was able to, we moved in and I took care of her for a year and a half. You know, I've been able to do things in my life and be okay. I went back to school. I got my bachelor's degree with four kids, which is, to me, mind-boggling. You know, and have a job where people depend on me, and I'm able to be of assistance to others, and, you know, I'm a part of my home group. I have a service commitment at our business meeting. You know, all those things get me to that point where if I'm doing what I need to do, I'm okay and I can feel okay, because I go through my day and I look for those moments, whether it's, you know, just a random gesture that my daughter is doing that makes me think that, you know, everything's okay. I'm where I need to be. And, you know, that's a really amazing way to live, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. That's all I have. Thanks.